Mark 14, verses 32 to 42. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that if it is possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and he found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Once more he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Second passage is Romans 3, verses 21 to 26. "But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus."
Good evening. It's great to welcome you to our NYC, especially if you're a visitor. My name is Tim Thorburn. I work as a staff worker at UWA with the Christian Union and as the regional director in WA for AFES. If you are visiting, whether you're used to be a student and now have graduated, whether you're a supporter and a financial partner, or maybe you're a year 11 or 12, just wondering what these uni groups are about, it's great to have you with us. This week, we're looking at a subject that could be seen as fairly dowry and sad, the death of Jesus. That's not something to be, well, you can't treat death lightly, but I'm going to try just to get us started. Some of you may be aware of a thing called the Darwin Awards. I introduced them to the students last night. The Darwin Awards are awarded to people who do humanity a great service by removing their genes from the human gene pool in spectacular fashion. Anybody get what I'm talking about yet? So there's some people that are so dumb that it's better that their genes aren't perpetuated in the human gene pool, and they show that they don't really need to be in the human gene pool by the way that they end their life, hopefully before they've reproduced. So to get a Darwin Award, you've got to do something really dumb, and it's got to be fatal. So some of you might have heard of tombstoning. Anybody heard of that? Anybody tried it? You probably have without knowing the real name for it. Tombstoning is jumping off cliffs into the water from as high as you can do it. I don't know why it's called tombstoning. I guess because you're jumping off cliffs, they look like big stones. Well, this is a few years ago now. No, last year it was. A Dutch football pro, Maurid Lambretta, was on vacation. He wanted to do something really spectacular, really fun, thrill seeker. And he had a lot of confidence in his own athletic ability. And so he jumped off a 30-metre high cliff. I think, unaware that if you jump from that high, your terminal velocity is about 90 kilometres an hour, which is pretty fast to hit water. Except he also didn't calculate that he was more than 10 metres away from the edge of the water, horizontally. And the world record for long jump is less than 10 metres. He didn't make it to the water, but he did make it to the rocks. And they have made a tombstone in his memory. So please don't be like him. Don't do something stupid. Keep your genes in the gene pool. Well, that's the light relief. Let's turn to something a little bit more serious. To some extent or other, we all live under the shadow of death. And that's a harrowing, probably the most harrowing of human experiences. For some, it's our own death. We're hit with cancer, we have a clothes shave, we get older. But if it's not us, it's others around us, family, friends, who die or face death. Because death is always tragic. My mum died a few years ago. The person who gave me life lost her life. I'd never known life without her, and now I had life without her. There was a void, a pain. At her funeral, there were about 40 of us gathered, family, friends, neighbours. But the other 7 billion people in this world were completely unmoved and oblivious to the death of my mum. Any one death is significant for a few people, but usually not for the rest of humanity. Jesus of Nazareth died, crucified outside Jerusalem, probably in the year 30 AD. A small crowd witnessed it. Some mourned, some mocked. At the time, it didn't seem very significant. It didn't make the news in Rome that night. It didn't break the internet like Tay-Tay. But Christianity makes much of that event, of the death of Jesus Christ. As you probably know, crosses are now symbols of Christianity. We put them on all our church buildings. We wear them around our necks. We call the day we celebrate his death Good Friday. And it's celebrated across the world, even in countries that make nothing of Jesus. We saw last night that Paul had an ambition, and his ambition was to never boast in anything except the cross of Christ. Tonight we're going to look at two passages that open a window for us to give us an insight what is going on when Jesus was crucified, why that death is much more significant than the death of my mum or any other person. We're going to spend more time on the first passage of Mark chapter 14 and some on the second from Romans chapter 3. But Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night before he's crucified helps us understand something of his own death by the way he experiences that event and what he prays. It's late in the night before Good Friday, before his arrest and crucifixion. He set his face to go from Galilee, rural backwaters, to Jerusalem months before this. And as he walked, he warned his disciples that when he got to Jerusalem, he would die. They tried to stop him. They were terrified of the prospect, but Jesus kept going. Earlier in this evening, he shared with them what we call the Last Supper. He'd given them pieces of bread to eat and said, "This is my body broken for you." They'd drunk from the same cup. He said, "This is my blood poured out for many." And then he leads his disciples into the garden to pray. And we see a very strange and unusual Jesus in the garden. We see him up close and personal. We see him in the raw in a way that we never see him anywhere else in his life. You can pick it up in verse 33. He took Peter and James and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. Now, the English translations have trouble getting the sense of these words. They're very emotional words. Deeply distressed has the sense of horror struck. Troubled, a loathsome aversion. Whatever's coming, he recoils in horror as he contemplates it. He says he's in anguish to the point of death. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He's in a cold sweat. It's almost like he'd rather die than go through with whatever is coming. Now, when we're with someone going through that sort of emotional experience, it's actually awkward for us, isn't it? I feel like I shouldn't be there. It's an invasion of privacy. When people are happy, when everything's good, we want to be there. We want to share it. Somebody wins an Olympic gold medal. What do? Well, the journalist shoves a microphone under their nose and they say, "How do you feel?" And we join them in the exuberance and the joy of something so good. But when somebody's like this, I don't want to be there, because Jesus is sort of falling apart in front of my eyes. It's painful to watch. And it's also very surprising. It's unexpected. It's unusual. Let me quickly give you three reasons why it's unexpected. I think most of us, if we know the story of Jesus, expect this emotional stuff the next day when he's on the cross, don't we? When he's been crucified and the nails are through his hands and it's excruciatingly painful, that's when we expect the movie close-ups, the camera framing the face with the pain and the emotion and the tears and the agony. But in Mark's account, it's here in the garden that we see Jesus like that. When he gives the account of Jesus' actual crucifixion, it's very matter of fact. There's no emotion in it whatsoever. He simply says, "And they crucified him." No close-ups, not like our movies, but here is the emotion. Why is that? I take it as because the pain of crucifixion is not what Jesus' death is about. The physical pain he suffers on the cross. Secondly, it's surprising because it's so different to the Jesus we've seen. If we've read the Gospels, if we know Matthew or Mark or Luke and John and seen the accounts and listened to them, because Jesus is always so in control of every situation. It doesn't matter what you throw at him, he seems to respond with poise. You might remember a time he was out in a boat with his disciples. It's at night, he's asleep, and this storm blows up. And the disciples are completely rattled. They think they're going to drown. They're bailing like hell trying to survive. Jesus is still asleep. They wake him up. Is he rattled like them? No, he simply stands up in the boat and he says to the wind and the waves, "Shut up. Calm down, will you?" And they do. He's totally at ease, no matter what you throw at him. In fact, you read chapter 15 of Mark. He's there before Pilate being tried. His life is on the line. Again, he's completely at ease, perfectly poised, in control of himself and what's happening. But not here. Why is Jesus so different? And many people would expect better of Jesus. Others have faced death without falling apart. Paul and Silas, two early Christian leaders, are arrested, thrown in prison. They expect they're likely to get executed the next day. And what are they doing? Falling apart like this? No, they're singing hymns. But Jesus isn't. Some of you may know the story of Socrates, the Athenian philosopher. He's condemned to death by the Council of Athens to drink hemlock. And as he stands there with the hemlock, the cup in his hands, he confidently expounds his confidence in the immortality of the soul and then calmly drinks his hemlock. Is Jesus just a wimp when it comes down to it? When he's put under pressure, is he a mere coward? Well, we get some insight, I think, into what is happening and how Jesus understands it from the prayer that he prays. It's recorded for us in the passage I put up on the screen for you so you can see it. He prays, "Abba, Father, everything is possible to you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." He prays to God as his Father. That has been Jesus' normal practice. He's very conscious that he's the Son of God, not merely a creature. He has confidence that he's his Father, who loves him, who listens, who provides. There's no hint of distance or resentment against God. And he prays to God as a powerful God. Nothing is impossible to you. Everything is possible. Whatever is coming, he could rescue Jesus from it, like he rescued Daniel from the lion's den. Which means if God doesn't rescue him, it's not because he can't, but he won't. It's not because he's unable, but unwilling. And the crux of the prayer is in that middle line. Take this cup from me. A heart-wrenching request for God to take a cup away for the impending hour that's coming to pass him by. Jesus describes what's coming as a cup. And metaphorically, he's saying the prospect of drinking this cup is what is causing all the distress and anguish. The contents of the cup are causing him stress. And so he prays, Father, take it away. But what is this cup? Nothing in the context helps us very much. It's clearly very, very unpleasant. In fact, painful to drink. Very different to the Passover cup he's just shared with his disciples. How do we work it out? Well, we do what we should do with any part of the New Testament. When there's something that puzzles us, we say, I wonder if there's some Old Testament background to this. Has God prepared the way for us so we can understand what it is? How would Jesus have used this image of the cup, given that he was soaked in the Old Testament scriptures? When you ask that question, the answer emerges pretty clearly and obviously, because the cup of the Lord is a phrase that comes throughout the Old Testament, many places, particularly in the prophets and some of the Psalms. Here's one reference. Isaiah chapter 51, verse 17. Awake, awake, rise up, Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, you who have drained to its dregs the goblet that makes people stagger. What's the cup? The cup is the cup of the wrath of God. And the picture is of people forced to drink it to its dregs. This is obviously no Margaret River Chardonnay. It's foul-tasting, foul-smelling. In those days, wine would go off, and when it went off, it really was terrible. You didn't want to drink it. And more than that, it had the dregs in the bottom, the mud, and it was vile sort of stuff. So as you drank it to the dregs, you got the mud left in your mouth. And so you not only had the vile taste in your mouth, the nausea in your stomach, it left you drunk and hungover. It's a picture, but you get the picture, don't you? It's spelt out a little bit in what it means in verse 19, that they've experienced double calamities that have come upon them, ruin and destruction, famine and sword. Who can console you? Because they're filled with the wrath of the Lord. That's what sends Jesus into a cold sweat. It's not the nails, but the wrath of God. If you're with us last night, we explored a little bit of God's wrath, his righteous, fair judgment on us who deserve it. But many people recoil at the idea of a wrathful God, of an angry God. And I can understand that to some extent, because we know that God is a God of love. And it doesn't seem easy to put it together to be compatible. Surely a loving God is soft and kind, not angry and wrathful at people. But wrath is not the opposite of love. In fact, wrath can be the right expression of love. Let me tell you a story, a true story. It was in the newspapers and the TV news 2 weeks ago in Perth. Referred to an event in December 2020. An intellectually disabled man called Alan Thomas was waiting for a train on Queen's Park Station. Early in the morning, standing on the platform, you can see him in the high vis in that picture. Some CCTV. He was going to work, just waiting for a train, minding his own business. Another man walked onto the platform. They didn't know each other. They had nothing to do with each other. And for an unknown reason, even to this day, the new man brutally assaulted Alan. He assaulted him so badly he left him completely unconscious. He rolled him off the edge of the platform onto the railway tracks and left him. Someone called the police. He was picked up before a train came, taken to hospital, but he died very soon after of the injuries. The judge in the case described it as a callous and brutal murder. Can I ask you, as you contemplate that story, how you feel Does it affect you at all? Are you moved by it? I hope so. I hope there's some compassion. But I presume there's some anger, isn't there? That someone can treat another human being like that. In fact, if you've got no anger, you've got no empathy, have you? You have no love for the victim and his family and those affected by it. So the opposite of love is not wrath. It's indifference in so many situations. How does God feel about human actions, about actions like this? Do you think God has got less moral fibre than you? Has he got less empathy than you? Has he got less love for victims than you? No, it's the opposite, isn't it? He's got more. And in his love and in his empathy, God is angry. Rightly so. How does God respond to the endless train of human evil, of murder and slander, of abuse and assault, of deceit and destruction, of human evil piled up to the sky? He is angry. He is full of wrath. He's slow to wrath. Yes, it's not a temper tantrum. It's a long-term settled conviction, storing up wrath for ourselves for the day of God's wrath, as we saw in Romans 2 last night. And what Jesus recoils from is not the sadistic torture by Roman soldiers, terrible as that is. It's not that agony of the physical death that is coming his way, but the experience of the full force of God's judgment on human evil, drinking the cup of God's wrath stored up for centuries and millennium. That is, experiencing hell, literally. And as he stares down the barrel of hell, he recoils in deep horror. He doesn't say, bring it on, but save me from this hour. He'd rather die than experience this. This is an experience worse than death, even the worst form of death. Friends, can I say to you, it tells us that hell is real. And hell is to be avoided at all costs. Hell is not some Christian scare tactic to try and get you to become a Christian, just coercing and manipulating you. Jesus knew what was coming, and he said, I want to avoid this if it is at all possible. And it tells us what's going on when Jesus is crucified. Because the primary action is not between Pilate and the soldiers and the mockers and Jesus. The primary action when Jesus is on the cross is between the Father and the Son, within God himself. The relationship between the Father and the Son is ruptured for the first time in all eternity, in some sense, as the Son consciously experiences the built-up wrath of God against all human evil. Darkness covers the land for 3 hours. And at the end of the 3 hours, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, what killed Jesus was not crucifixion, but forsakenness. And what is God's answer to his request? Take this cup from me. Well, we've already foreshadowed it. We know what it's going to be. But let's settle in that for a little bit. Jesus utters this deep, heartfelt, earnest prayer to his Father, take this cup from me, spare me. But we need to notice something else before we see God's answer. Jesus adds a rider to that prayer. He says, yet not my will, but yours be done. He rightly asks to be spared, but there's something even more important to Jesus, doing the will of his Father. You see, this is not some picture of an angry father forcing a reluctant son to go through with some terrible ordeal and suffering and pain. That would be child abuse. No, the father and the son want the same thing. There's no tension between the father and the son. They're of one heart. The tension is within the son himself. He does want to drink the cup and he doesn't want to drink the cup. He's willing to go through with it and he doesn't want to go through with it. That's what we see, in a sense, unresolved. There's his prayer. Take this cup from me. And what is the Father's answer? No. A clear no. And Jesus knows that by the end of this passage even. He says the hour has come. Within 12 hours, he's been arrested, tried, condemned, and crucified. Within 18 hours, he's dead and buried. He drank the cup to its dregs. The Father says no to his own Son because there was no other way. There is no other way for us to be saved than for him to drink the cup. Well, let's go to our second passage. If you've got Bibles, you might like to turn to Romans chapter 3. We'll do this more quickly and just pick out a few salient parts of it. Romans 3 is a retrospective. If the garden is a prospective, what is coming in the death of Jesus, Romans 3 looks back on what happened and what it achieved. Last night we looked at some of chapter 1, verse 18 through to chapter 3. He pretty much summarizes it in verses 10 to 12. There is no one righteous, not even one, no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away, all have suppressed the truth and gone their own way. I want you to see, though, that verse 21 starts with a very, very important word. The word is but. I actually think in the Bible, the best word in the whole Bible is the word but. Because but changes. It's a game changer. You know, if I say to you, listen, I like you, but I've suddenly changed the whole thing, haven't I? You know, I like you, that sounds positive. It sounds like, yeah, there's something going to happen here. But if I say but, all bets are off, aren't they? It changes, excuse me, changes everything. You know, if I say the West Coast Eagles have lost the last 12 games, well, it's hard to say that positively, isn't it? What a disaster. But if I can say they lost the last 12 games, but we're going to win next week, suddenly everything is different, isn't it? Life looks up. And Paul says, but, that is, things have changed. The situation that was there has been flipped. Our situation is no longer determined by what used to be, defined by that previous reality that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And with but, he's got a particular event in mind, as we'll see. Now, verses 21 to 26 are a pretty dense paragraph. We're just going to pull out a few key ideas. The first one is in verse 25. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood. Now, the NIV translates a single word, sacrifice of atonement. If you translated it just more literally into English, you'd probably use the word propitiation. But the NIV translators reckon that most of us don't know what the word propitiation is, so they give us a sort of roundabout way of telling us what it is, a sacrifice of atonement. But propitiation is a very important idea, even if I don't know the word. To make propitiation is to make somebody propitious. Now, that probably doesn't help any of you. Let me try and explain a bit more then. To make somebody propitious is it assumes that there's a state of enmity, tension, anger, we're offside with each other, but there's an action that changes that. So the person is now pleased with us. We're reconciled relationally because they've been made propitious towards us, positive towards us. In the ancient world, it was a common idea, especially in the religious realm, of propitiating the gods, making an offering to propitiate the gods that might be angry. I did have a slide, but I didn't get into this. Some of you might know the myth of Troy. You know the Trojan horse, that whole myth? Troy was a city in sort of, we call it Turkey today, and the Greeks wanted to conquer it. And in the myth, the Greek general is trying to get his troops, mainly on boats, to Troy so they can attack it and conquer it, except everything goes against them. Whenever they try to sail towards Troy, the wind turns the other way, or their ships barge into each other and sink each other. It just doesn't seem to be working. And the general, the Greek general, draws the conclusion that their god, Artemis, their goddess, must be angry with them. That's why everything is going wrong. So he does a propitiation. He calls in his daughter and he sacrifices his daughter to make Artemis propitious towards their mission to attack Troy. Now, that idea that God might be like that makes most of us feel pretty uncomfortable. An angry God, maybe, but a fickle God like that, that can be bought and manipulated like Artemis can be, doesn't seem to be true, and I don't want a God like that. But I want you to notice that in Romans 3, propitiation works very, very differently. Who offered the propitiation in Troy? That's the Greek general, isn't it? He does it. Terrible way to do it, gets his daughter and kills her. Who offers the propitiation here in Romans 3? Is it us? No. God is the one. The Father presents Jesus as a propitiation. This is not some external thing. It is a sacrifice. It's the shedding of his blood. But it's not by you or me offering our daughter or our sister or our brother or our pet. It's God himself propitiating himself. And so we see again what's happening when Jesus dies is primarily within God, the Father and the Son. The Father pours out all his righteous anger at human sin on his own Son. Not an unwilling Son, but a willing Son. Because the true and living God is not fickle and capricious. He's not able to be bought off by us just by offering something that he might want, sending him a sop. But he satisfies his own anger, his own justice at evil, in the death of his own Son. So what is the death of Jesus? We talked about it as a propitiation. Here's just a little table that sets out a couple of things about it. You can think about Christ's death as being certain things and achieving certain things. It's a sacrifice of blood. It's a substitution. One dies for another. It's propitiating, a propitiation, bringing harmony. It's a ransom paid to free those in captivity. It's atonement, making people one. It's an example of love and self-sacrifice to follow. And it achieves various things. It achieves cleansing and forgiveness, justification, reconciliation, redemption and freedom, victory over the forces of evil and death. It achieves salvation and a new covenant between God and humanity. It can inspire us. It achieves lots of things because it is lots of things. And in this passage, Paul specifies some of those things that we'll just look at very briefly. But before we do, it's worth noticing that some of the what it is and what it achieves sort of connect with each other. They imply each other. So by propitiation, we are reconciled to a God who is rightly angry with us. That is, we're living in the world of human relationships. Sorry, not human, personal relationships. It's a ransom. It pays the price for our redemption. Just to explore some of those ideas briefly, he talks about it in verse 24 as a redemption. It moves from the world of personal relationships to the world of the slave markets. Because slaves in those days could be set free if someone came and paid the ransom price. And therefore the enslaved person was set free. And we too are under the power of sin and evil and death and Satan. We can't escape. We can't buy our own freedom. But Christ offers himself as a ransom to redeem us and bring freedom. Now, if you push that too far, it sort of doesn't work. The early church often emphasized this idea of ransom. And then people ask the question, who did God pay the ransom to? Some people said, oh, Satan. But if you start to think that through, it has terrible implications, which just aren't true. Now, ransom is more of a picture, a metaphor, if you like. He also talks about justification. We're justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. We've moved now from the slave markets to the law court. Justification is the opposite of condemnation. Instead of being found guilty and condemned, we're found innocent. We have nothing to answer for. we are justified right in the eyes of God. It's a verdict that is given, not because we've lived righteous lives, but because all our unrighteousness has been transferred to Jesus. He was condemned in my place. The idea of substitution. And I think that helps make sense of the way that Jesus dies. Jesus dies for us not by dying of old age, not by dying of cancer, but by dying as a condemned criminal, because that's the death that we deserve. And so we're given the status of justified, not by our performance, but by what Christ has done. And one of God's goals in doing all this is in himself to act justly. Says it a few times in the passage. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness, that is, his justice and goodness in passing over sins. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time, and so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. God won't just forgive. He doesn't say, oh, it's okay, just I'll forget what you've done. That would be unjust and would be very unloving to the victims of our sin and evil. Jesus' death is God's righteous way of righteously justifying the unrighteous. Let me try and say that a bit more clearly. Jesus' death is how a righteous God can rightly treat unrighteous people as righteous. How a righteous God can righteously treat unrighteous people as righteous. God will always act righteously. He can't go against his nature, and he won't. He won't just forgive. If we're to be forgiven, justice must be done, and it is in the death of Jesus. And in verse 24, he says that all this is by grace. We didn't do anything for it. We were just bystanders watching. He did it all. We didn't deserve it. It's unadulterated generosity. A pure gift. And what links people to Jesus' death? The word he uses is faith. It's to be received by faith. How do we benefit? Well, the connection is a response of faith. Because for some people, Jesus' death is just an obscure event in ancient history. No connection to them. They don't want any connection to their lives. And they don't benefit from it. But to be received by faith, that is by trusting in Jesus and his death, that he died my death, your death for you. Now, the word faith has got very mucked up in lots of places. There's a story of an early Christian missionary to the New Hebrides, we call it Vanuatu today, a guy called John Patton. And he was trying to translate the Bible into the local language, but he couldn't find a word to translate faith. They didn't seem to have that concept in their language. And one day he was sitting with his translator on a beach, and he saw a very old, frail man being helped to hobble along the beach by a young, strong man. And he was sort of, you know, arms around him, one was almost carrying the other. And John Patton asked the translator, what's your word for that? No, not what the young guy's doing, what the old guy's doing. And the guy told him a word which roughly translated is leaning heavily upon. And John said, that's the word. That's faith. Leaning heavily upon Jesus and not on yourselves. If we go back to the table. Let's go back to the table. We see that the Bible does use multiple ways to explain the significance of Christ's death and what it achieves for people like you and me. But if you ask the question, the important question, what is at the heart? What's at the core? If you took it away and just left with the others, what would eradicate the others even of meaning? And the answer is, I think, penal substitution. That Jesus died in our place, taking the punishment we deserve for our sin. Sometimes it's called penal substitutionary atonement. And I think in the Bible's teaching, as we've seen from Mark chapter 14 and from Romans chapter 3, it is at the core of what Jesus does and achieves. The others don't make sense without it. We've already seen that with ransom. It, if you start to pick into the picture of ransom, it starts to fall apart unless you understand that we're ransomed by penal substitution. Well, if you think about the example, Jesus sets us an example of incredible self-sacrificial love, and that is true. Some people think that's all that Jesus' death does. But that really doesn't make sense, does it? If I say to you, I love you, I want the best for you, I'm going to demonstrate how much I love you by jumping in front of a bus and getting myself killed, I presume you'd say, that's just stupid. That's not love, is it? It's only love if my death achieves something for you, something concrete, something absolutely needed for you, like saving you from being hit by the bus. So without substitutionary atonement, all these other pictures of Jesus' death lose their significance and their meaning. They don't actually make sense. Now, why do I make a point of that? Partly for us and the truth and trusting Jesus ourselves, but also because I think at the moment there are many Christians, as there have been in previous generations, who don't like this idea of penal substitution and deny it. And deny it for not biblical reasons, but probably, usually, I think, for cultural reasons. Now, let me give you one example. I do this with some trepidation because the Bible Project is something that I actually really find valuable. You know the Bible Project? You've seen the videos. And some of their videos are really brilliant. They just capture some of the structure and message of biblical books really clearly. But can I warn you, brothers and sisters, that the makers of the Bible Project do not believe that Jesus died bearing the wrath of God against our sin. They teach against it explicitly, and it undermines their explanation of many parts of the Bible. They've removed any reference to God's righteous anger against sinners from all of their publications, all their videos, all their online articles and blogs. Now, they say things like this: as our representative, Jesus took into himself all of the just consequences of the pain, the sin, and the death that we have caused in the world. And you first read it and think, that sort of sounds right, doesn't it? But notice it's very horizontal. Jesus takes into himself the consequences of the sin, the pain, the death that we cause each other in the world. It's not the vertical between us and God, the Father drinking the cup of God's wrath, so that we are spared that cup. So let's think about this crucial event. It's a crucial event because it alone addresses and solves humanity's crucial need to be rescued from God, from God's condemnation for our evil, from God's sentence of death and hell forever in his righteous wrath against us. In Christ's death, God rescues us from our terrible predicament. Back in Mark, we've been with Jesus in the garden. We've been privy to that most private moment in Jesus' life, that intense emotional moment. We've seen him up close and personal, distressed, and for me it's distressing to see it. And we've heard him pray, Abba Father, take this cup from me. Jesus knows that what's coming is not so much the physical agony of the nails pulling at his sinews, that his muscles screaming in agony, the birds circling to pick at his eyes and mouth even before he's dead. Jesus knows that the core of what is going to happen when he's crucified is that he will bear the heavy load of human sin, mine and yours. He'll be crushed by the hot wrath of a righteous God against human evil piled up to the sky. And that prospect frightens the life out of him. That is worse than dying. And he prays to the Father, please spare me. And the Father says, no. Now ponder for a minute. What could motivate the Father of lights, the Father of this Son for eternity, to refuse the pleading of his Son? Some of you are fathers. You know what it's like when your children come and ask you for something and they're desperate and you know they need it. You want to give it to them, don't you? How could you refuse them? But this father says no to his son. And what could motivate the son to go through with it, to say, your will be done, when he knows what it's going to feel like, when he knows he will face a suffering of such immense magnitude that is unimaginable? There's only one answer to those questions, I think, and that is that the Father and the Son love us deeply, very deeply. Paul puts it like this in Romans chapter 5. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, although sometimes you hear about it, don't you? But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were sinners, while we were his enemies, Christ died for us. That is love of a magnitude beyond anything I know, anything I've done. But historically, real. The Father said no to his Son. The Son said, your will be done. That is the love of the Father and the Son for you and for me. Do you ever doubt that God is truly for you? All sorts of things make us doubt. Some of us just overthink everything, don't we? Whatever happens, we just get in a tiz about it. Some of us have had experience that have been deeply distressing, and we can no longer be confident that God really does love us and have our best interests at heart. But Paul says this: he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how could he not, how will he not, along with him, give us all good things? He is for us. He is for you. And whenever you doubt it, think back to the garden. Father, take this cup from me, but not my will, but yours be done. That will help convince us and quieten our troubled hearts. Secondly, do you see the necessity of Christ's death? If there was any other way that we could be right with God, that we could avoid the just destiny that's coming to us, apart from the Son dying, surely the Father would have said, yes, yes, I'll take the cup from you, if there was any other way. If you and I weren't in such deep, terrible strife, would Jesus have gone through with this? He saw clearly what it would involve. He shuddered. Would he have gone through if it was unnecessary? So if you or your neighbour think, oh, I'll be okay. I've sort of tried hard enough, haven't I? And maybe I can work out some private personal arrangement with God. We've got something going here. Please think again. See, it founders on a brute fact of history. Jesus died. Jesus drank the cup. And it bluntly contradicts any such hope. I remember having a conversation with a couple of law students at UWA. And they engaged. It was a terrific conversation. They were pretty honest and they told me a few things that they didn't like about Christianity. I was able to share something about Jesus with them. And sort of, I think to wind up the conversation, one of them said to me, Tim, that's fine for you, but it's not for me. And I was feeling a bit cheeky. So I said to her, that makes Jesus look pretty stupid then, doesn't it? And she sort of did a bit of a double take and said, what do you mean? I said, well, Jesus thought he needed to die for you. You thought that was a waste of time and effort. Which of you is right? One of you is completely dumb, aren't you? If you don't need it, Jesus shouldn't have gone through with it. If you do need it, then why are you saying you don't? You see, in a sense, it's just a brute fact of history. Jesus went through with it. That means I must need it. Is there any other option than that? And so it's foolish to think that being a good Hindu or Muslim or atheist will somehow get you through. It's a blasphemy, I think, to say, well, I've got the right to do and be what I want to be. God ought to be okay with that. In the Garden of Gethsemane, we see with crystal clarity what my life deserves. It deserves hell. And we see with crystal clarity that God loves me, Father and Son. And it's done what is needed to save me from hell at the cost of himself. if you're with my law friends, Jesus shouldn't have bothered. Can I ask you to rethink? To rethink your own attitude and your own response and your own life. Come to your senses. If you want to come to your senses, if you're ready to do that, if you want to stop suppressing the truth about God and lean on Jesus, his death for you, tonight would be a really good night to do it, wouldn't it? How do you do it? Well, there's a change of heart involved. There's putting your confidence in Jesus, no longer in yourself and what you've been or done. And there's a beginning of relating to God and trusting him. So you might say something like this. These are not magic words, but this is the sort of thing you might say. Lord God, I apologise for living my own way and not trusting in your son and his death for me. Please forgive me. Thank you for sending your son to die the death I deserve. I turn to Jesus, trusting in his death as my only hope for forgiveness. Please help me to live for him. Does that express what you want to do? I don't want you to do something you don't want to do. But if that's where you're at, can I invite you to pray that to God in the quietness of your own heart? I'm just going to repeat it. If it's appropriate for you, please, in your own heart, follow me. Lord God, I apologise for living my own way and not trusting in your son and his death for me. Please forgive me. Thank you for sending your son to die the death I deserve. I turn to Jesus, trusting in his death as my only hope for forgiveness. Please help me to live for him. Amen. Can I say, if you've prayed that genuinely, God has heard you. He's forgiven you. You've started a new life. And like any beginning of new life, it's really helpful to have help from friends. I encourage you, therefore, to tell somebody that that's what you've done and invite them. Tell a Christian friend. If you don't know who to tell, come and tell me. Tell someone, so they can help you learn how to live this new life. But the rest of us, can we rejoice in what God has done for us in his son? We're going to sing some songs that will give us a chance to express some of that joy and faith and gratitude.